relentless Israeli bombings keep claiming innocent Palestinian lives as the death toll in the Gaza Strip climbs to nearly 18,800. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says its forces have killed at least 10 Israeli soldiers east of Gaza City. Also in the headlines, Iran has warned about Israel's plans to expel Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to neighboring countries.
Well, welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us.
More Palestinians have been killed as Israel keeps pressing ahead with its genocidal onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip. At least 20 people were killed in overnight Israeli strikes on Rafah in southern Gaza. Reports say that many children are still trapped under the rubble. In northern Gaza, bodies of 10 Palestinians have been retrieved after Israeli warplanes struck the Jabalia refugee camp there. As part of their ethnic cleansing campaign, the regime's forces also carried out an execution-style massacre at a school near the Jabalia camp. Eyewitnesses said that Israeli troops entered the classrooms and opened fire on women and children. The regime continues to target schools, refugee camps, and hospitals, where thousands of displaced Palestinians have taken shelter. Nearly 18,800 Palestinians have been killed in relentless Israeli bombings and shelling since October the 7th. With Israeli onslaught on Gaza has worsened the long-standing water crisis in the besieged territory. Over 2 million Gazans are now struggling for clean water, with many being forced to use seawater despite health risks. Let's take a listen to some of the residents describing their dire situation.
There is no water at all. We are forced to bottle seawater and use it daily. As you can see, they have demolished our homes. Even food and drinking water cannot be found. We are truly in the midst of a great suffering.
We don't have water because of the war. We come here to drink seawater, even though it is unhealthy. But we need water, whatever its source is.
All of us here have nowhere to go but to the sea. There is no other place to go because the bombing is everywhere. Even here on the seashore, the bombing follows us. A family was bombed and killed while they were just sitting here on the beach. Unfortunately, even the sea has become dangerous, but we have no other place.
The ongoing Israeli-U.S. genocidal onslaught on Gaza has displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are barely surviving in tents with no access to food, water, or electricity. In the past week, relentless Israeli bombardment forced some 120,000 Gazans to flee to the southern coastal town of Al-Mawasi. Some of the displaced people recount their harrowing experience there. Let's take a listen.
My experience has been that for the past 8 days I've been sleeping outdoors on the bare ground. People here helped me settle a tent with plastic sheets and pieces of wood. Besides that, we don't even have the most basic necessities. No clothes since we arrived here. We haven't changed clothes. The children have been sleeping on the sandy ground since we arrived, but later the Red Crescent gave us 2 blankets. I collected some fabric through begging, found some cushions from destroyed cars so the children can sleep on them.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There is no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
I have 4 children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
When we arrived here, we found it's a desert with nothing. We had to set up tents. It rained on the first day and the children couldn't sleep. Throughout the night, we tried everything to keep them warm. There's no electricity, no water, no facilities and no food. When we tried to buy food, we couldn't find anything. We can't survive. It's very difficult.
Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as the lack of medicine and clean water there. Let's take a listen.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad. Added to, of course, the levels of gastroenteritis, the number of cases has increased to 4 times its normal levels regarding the water being consumed by children, most of which is water unfit for human consumption. The food, most of which is canned. People have lost fresh food. There are no fruit, no vegetables. Children have a deficiency in vitamins, immune deficiency, in addition to iron deficiencies and anemia from the lack of nutrition.
We need urgent intervention to end this suffering because we are coming to a disastrous health crisis that has no solution. There will be epidemics of all contagious diseases across Rafah that is sheltering around 1 million people.
In all my professional life and for around 2 years I've been employed at this hospital, we've never been through a situation like this. And to be honest, we never expected this situation could happen to us, especially since the Martyr Muhammad Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital is small and it doesn't have the capabilities to deal with these numbers in the hundreds daily coming to us in the emergency, and most of which honestly need to be admitted to wards.
Palestinian resistance fighters are stepping up retaliatory operations against Israeli forces inside and outside of the Gaza Strip. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says its forces have killed at least 10 Israeli soldiers in Shijaiya, east of Gaza City. The Al-Qassam Brigade says its fighters also targeted IOF soldiers in the Zaytun district of Gaza City with heavy caliber mortar shells. An IOF soldier was killed in Sheikh Radwan neighborhood. Several Israeli tanks and armored vehicles also came under attack with Al Yassin rockets. Intense battles between invading Israeli troops and resistance fighters continue across the coastal strip. The regime has so far confirmed the death of nearly 116 forces in Gaza since it launched a ground invasion nearly 2 months ago. However, Hamas says the casualties among Israeli forces are much higher and that the regime is hiding the real number. Israeli forces have killed 3 Palestinians during an early Thursday drone strike targeting an eastern neighborhood in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. According to the Palestinian media, the strike, which also injured 10 people, targeted a group of city residents. Israeli forces fired several missiles at a number of Palestinian homes in the neighborhood. The regime forces also fatally shot a 17-year-old boy in the Jenin refugee camp. They also blew up a home in the Jenin refugee camp, setting it on fire. The new fatalities bring to 12 the number of Palestinians killed in the city since Tuesday. Israel has stepped up its attacks across the occupied territory since October 7, when the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza. Since then, regime forces and settlers have killed more than 285 Palestinians and detained hundreds more across the West Bank. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details on the recent Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin.
In the Jenin area, the operation started early on Tuesday. It's the longest military raid since 2002. The Israeli forces are surrounding the hospitals, mainly the Jenin government hospital. The Israelis are not allowing Palestinians to take the bodies from the hospitals in order to bury them. They are holding the bodies in the mortuaries of the hospitals. It's yet another collective punishment Palestinians there in Jenin are facing. Israeli forces opened fire at paramedics, ambulances, media crews in order not to allow them to enter Jenin or even to enter a number of neighborhoods within the city of Jenin, like the eastern neighborhood where the Israeli military carried out another drone attack, killed on Thursday 3 Palestinians and wounded at least 10, according to the Ministry of Health. 3 of those 10 Palestinians who had been wounded are in serious condition. The Israelis had also used missiles and bombed 3 houses in Jenin. Yesterday, yet another Palestinian house was bombed by the Israelis. It was the house of one of the leaders of the Jenin Brigade, Uday al-Bajawi. His house was bombed by the Israelis.
The Iranian foreign minister has warned of Israeli plans for the forced expulsion of the Palestinians from northern Gaza to the south and neighboring countries. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking to Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva. The minister called on the agency to give its firm support to the people in Gaza. He urged the UNHCR to prevent a new wave of Palestinian displacement. The Iranian official also met with his Burkina Faso counterpart, Olivia Rouamba, on the sidelines of the Global Refugee Forum in Switzerland. Amir Abdullahian underlined the resistance of the Palestinians to free their country from occupation. He said the resistance was legal under international law and the UN Charter. According to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, nearly 1.9 million people in Gaza have been displaced since Israel began its onslaught on October the 7th. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has rejected the Israeli claim that post-war Gaza will not be governed by the resistance group.
Any arrangement in Gaza or in the Palestinian cause without Hamas or their resistance factions is a delusion and a mirage. A delusion and a mirage.
Hamas was reacting to Israeli officials who disclosed the regime's plan for the future of the besieged Palestinian Strip. Hania, however, said that Hamas is open to discuss any ideas or initiatives aimed at ending Israel's aggression against Gaza. He also expressed readiness for talks that could lead to a, quote, political path, securing the right of the Palestinians to have an independent state with Al-Quds as its capital. Hania also touched on the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, saying that it dealt a resounding blow to the occupying regime and shook its military and political establishments. He underlined that Hamas military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, has inflicted heavy losses on the Zionist enemy in the ongoing battles in Gaza. Journalist and activist Khalid Barakat earlier joined us from Vancouver with his take on the Israeli plan for post-war Gaza.
We saw a new U.S. approach, and that is the United States and its Western allies are trying to push again for something that they just invented called renewing the Palestinian Authority. It really doesn't mean anything at all. It's vague, just like the so-called two-state solution that the United States sometimes uses as rhetoric. Although Palestinians across the board refuses two-state solution, with the exception of some of the Palestinian collaborators who work for Israel, but the vast majority of Palestinians are against the so-called two-state solution, simply because it does not respond to Palestinian people's rights. Palestinians have been struggling for the past 100 years to liberate their land, and for the past 75 years to return and liberation. People are not sacrificing their life for a state. But Brother Hania was responding to the day after the ceasefire, because there is a condition that they're trying to, the United States trying to impose, and that is a new authority. Of course, that exclude the Palestinian resistance. Now, when we look at the last polls in Palestine, over 85% of Palestinians support the Palestinian resistance.
Fred Asak is a board member at Africa for Palestine who joins us from Johannesburg. Welcome to the program. We've just had the Iranian foreign minister in our news where he has said that this forced displacement of Palestinians, from what we understand when he said to neighboring countries, is obviously a mistake. We have heard about how Israel has had plans to actually do that, in itself a war crime, to displace forcibly displace Palestinians to Egypt, and the ones from the Gaza Strip into Jordan, and even reports of Saudi Arabia to be an option. Doesn't that, first of all, give the definition of another Nakba for Palestinians, and B, it's the easy way out for Israel in terms of an occupying regime to get rid of the problem?
Absolutely. And mercifully, despite the fact that the Arab regimes on the whole, and this includes Egypt and Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that they aren't really fully inside the Palestinian camp, mercifully, they have shown no inclination or support for the idea of opening their borders for the Palestinian refugees. Basically, behind this idea of sending the Palestinians into Egypt or, in the new idea, to Saudi Arabia, it is part of a seriously racist logic. It's like saying, the black people of South Africa during apartheid, why didn't they just flee to Zimbabwe or to Zambia? The whole of Africa was open for all these black people. And so All the Arab world is there. Why don't the Palestinians go to these Arab countries? No, no, no. It is a question of dispossessing people from their own land. And this, of course, is a crime. It's a war crime because international law, not that international law is such a great thing to invoke, but international law demands that a people occupied should not be displaced. And so this is yet another example of the Israeli regime furthering their project of genocide and ethnic cleansing.
And how would you describe the U.S. role, where it has said on more than one occasion that that is not the plan when it comes to Palestinians, as recent as just last week, I believe, maybe a little over a week ago, where the VP Harris came out and said, no, they are not going to be pushed into Egypt. We're not going to have that happen, or for boundaries to even be altered.
Yes, and then they go further and they say that, no, the Palestinian Authority should be encouraged or pushed or to take over the control of the Gaza Strip. And so first of all, anything that comes from the U.S. should not be trusted. The U.S. is a firm ally of Israel, and in many cases it engages in the kinds of tactics that the apartheid security police invoke, where the one side pretends to be more to your side and the other side pretends to be really vicious against you. And then at the end of the day, they have what they call a settlement, which is really another victory for the occupying regime. So the United States, any idea that comes from them should be dismissed. And they should be the very last ones to pretend to be concerned about the deaths and the carnage and the genocide of the Palestinians.
Thank you very much for that. Fareed Asak, board member of the Africa for Palestine from Johannesburg. Many thanks.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Al-Aqsa Storm Aftermath. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. October 7th, 2023 was a turning point in the history of the West Asian region, and it will remain forever. On that day, the combatants of the Palestinian Hamas movement launched a surprise attack against the Zionist regime and imposed the biggest defeat on the regime since its illegitimate birth 75 years ago. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubbed the defeat as an irreparable defeat. We have reviewed the issue in a special series with a focus on the Al-Aqsa storm and its consequences. Stay tuned for another part, please. According to the reports and media data, Operation Al-Aqsa Storm has caused enormous unprecedented financial losses for the Zionist regime. These losses can be assessed in two parts of direct and indirect ones. Direct losses of Operation Al-Aqsa Storm are the military expenses assumed by the regime, and indirect losses are the ones that have been incurred upon companies and infrastructures of Israel. The Zionist daily Yediot Aharonot announced that the recent war on Gaza has cost very dearly for the regime. According to the assessments of the Zionist Ministry of Finance, the expenses of the war have amounted to nearly $6.7 billion in the past month. The daily adds that this amount is almost 15% of the Zionist regime's annual GDP. It is also more than 50% of the regime's budget in 2023, approximately $500 billion. Channel 12 of the Zionist regime, in a report from the session of the Finance Ministry senior managers with the security officials, said that every day of war has cost nearly 1 billion shekels for the regime, and this includes the direct expenses of war, such as the salary of soldiers, the fuel of fighters, provision of food and military ammunition and equipment. Some other Zionist sources have announced that the U.S. aids to the occupying regime have amounted to approximately $9 billion, which have mainly spent on purchase of arms and ammunition. The central bank of the Zionist regime has also announced the expenses imposed on the economy of the regime have reached 2.3 billion shekels per week due to the shortage of workforce. The bank adds that these expenses are caused by the closure of many schools in various parts of the occupied territories and displacement of nearly 144,000 workforces from the regions adjacent to Gaza and the Lebanese borders. The information released by the Employment Office of the Zionist regime indicates a serious increase of unemployed persons in October, concurrent with the outbreak of the war. According to the monthly report of this office, 70,000 people had been announced as unemployed, and this number has registered a 460% increase in comparison with the previous month. In other words, the number was 12,500 in September. In addition, the Zionist regime has recruited 360,000 reserve forces out of 400,000 ones to be recruited and organized for war. This scale of recruitment needs huge expenses. Moreover, expelling this high number of workforce from factories, educational and professional centers has dealt indirect blows on the economy of the regime. According to the reports, Haifa has almost become closed and no foreign ship comes to its shores. Furthermore, the Zionist regime has evacuated almost 250,000 settlers from the northern settlements bordering with Lebanon to the south. 55 settlements have also been evacuated near Gaza with 50,000 inhabitants. Therefore, at least 300,000 residents of inside the occupied Palestine have been transferred to other places. This has cost billions of dollars for the regime. The financial advisory company Leader Capital Markets, whose central bureau is in Tel Aviv, has estimated that the total expenses of the war will amount to $48 billion for 2023 to 2024. It adds that Israel will probably be forced to pay two-thirds of the money, and the rest will be paid by its comrades in crime, the United States and other countries. Another issue is that the war on Gaza has brought foreign and domestic investment to halt, as invest needs stability and security, both of which have been lost by the Zionist regime. Another point to note is that the Zionist regime has lost its raison d'être, which had been announced by its funders, namely, attraction of all Jews from across the world. The notorious first prime minister of the Zionist regime, Ben-Gurion, had said, "Migration to Palestine is like the blood which ensures the life of Israel and guarantees its security and future." He added, "We have taken territories, but without settlement of Jews, they won't have real value. Settlement is the real conquest." The fact is that the issue of population has always been a quintessential matter for the Zionists all over the world, because without it, the regime loses its sense. Zionists have left no stone unturned to materialize this strategic goal for the past decades. They have depicted and propagated ideal goals for migrants to persuade them to come to Palestine. But migration to the region has spectacularly decreased for the recent years due to lack of security and high price of life in the occupied territories. ERI Research Institute in Tel Aviv wrote in 2 months ago that the Jewish youth have lost trust in the Zionist regime and its organizations. The report of the institute adds that while 66% of the youth aged 18 to 44 had said that they would not leave Israel if possible, this number has decreased to 46% in 2023, and 54% of the youth have said that they would like to test migration practically. The trend of migration from the Western countries to the occupied territories has been seriously on decrease since 2023. This trend has decreased 30% compared to that of 2021. For sure, there are many causes for this reverse migration from the occupied Palestine. After the recent war in Gaza, some of the nationals of other countries have decided to leave the occupied Palestine and go back to their country. Yair Lapid, head of the Israeli opposition and the former prime minister of the Zionist regime, said that Israel is no more a safe place. Neral Aviv Kochai, who was the chief of staff of the Israeli army until early 2023, has said on the effects of the war on people in the occupied territories, "People are likely to decide not to live with this chronic disease in security. They will leave the country or they will not accept anymore to go to Al-Jalil in the north or other regions in the south. They will say that they don't want to stay in the so-called divine land to live with this chronic disease."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So, dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. So what happens is you and I, who have this heavy responsibility of preparing our children and ourselves to be the soldiers of the Imam, we need, more than anyone else, these lessons on karama. Now, today, we'd like to cover five questions. What are the miraculous effects of karama on human behavior? How different is someone who has karama when it comes to human behavior? When we look at the ahadith of Ahlul Bayt, we'll see that many of those noble traits that we admire, that we look and we say, well, subhanAllah, when we see them embodied in someone, if you look at the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt, they'll tell you these traits are the result of karama. The traits that we're going to talk about are going to cover three major areas of human life. What are the three areas that will be affected in a big way through karama if a parent can train his child to literally be someone of Islamic self-worth? Remember those hadiths that we've already talked about before for the first 7 years? The idea of intense love that the Ahlul Bayt have talked about. Intense love. The idea of me as a parent playing games with my children. But Amir al-Mu'mineen says, and when you play games, be a child. Giving freedom. All of those different things that they talked about for the first 7 years. What happens if the person gets karama? What's going to be some of the effects? Three areas we're going to be looking at. One of them will be the outlook, the mindset, the take of the person who has karama on the responsibilities that Allah has placed on his or her shoulders. Those divine takalif, those duties, that will be something that will be transformed by the discussion of karama. Number two will be the interactions between the mu'min or mu'mina and others. Number two. Number three is going to be certain spiritual changes that take place in the heart of the person who has karama. And those spiritual changes, when they take place, the outward effect is going to be spectacular. So those three areas. So it's a game changer. One quick point of order, though. One disclaimer. I just have to be honest. Just because a set of parents, mastered the training of a child, make sure they mastered how to raise a child with karama, if we've mastered it, if we've implemented it properly, does it guarantee that the traits that are mentioned as a result of karama will happen? The answer is no. For instance, as an example, one of the results of karama will be bravery. Legendary bravery. But does it mean that the only thing I need to focus on when it comes to the training of my children is karama? And if I do that, then 100% I'm guaranteed to have my children turn out to be brave? No. Because there are some other factors that go into bravery. For instance, as an example, there are certain other teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, certain other choices that the person has to make. So I don't want to oversell karama, but what we're doing is doing our responsibility and creating the grounds, giving our children that fighting chance at greatness. Okay, our next question is this. What's the relationship between karama and taqwa? What's the relationship between karama and taqwa? But taqwa now, that isn't forced. It's internal. The person's self-motivated. One of the major things that we're going to learn if karama is properly enacted, is that the person wants to stay away from things that are ugly, things that are disgusting, things that are low. A non-kareem would struggle with these things. A person with karama would find that they're easy to take do. These responsibilities are easy to do. One kind of reminder is this. Sometimes, this is a little bit of a warning. If there is a parent who's very concerned about raising my children right, but unfortunately, my method of tarbiyah involves disproportionate punishment. Disproportionate punishment. If my method of tarbiyah isn't one where I'm my child's best friend, but rather one where I'm just constantly barking out orders. If I'm always, and going overboard with this, monitoring and controlling. I'm not saying that it's not right to do to a certain extent, but if it's too much control on controlling, it doesn't foster that sense of karama. Our children, instead, they'll run towards areas where they can feel safe with their friends. They might even dislike religious circles and religious gatherings. It's a little bit of a warning. Karama, on the other hand, has those spectacular effects. We're going to talk about the effect that it has on taqwa. But misusing, right? Out of fear sometimes, we're operating from fear. I haven't learned to trust God enough to implement it the way of the Ahlul Bayt. Sometimes the results are the opposite. Now, a person who has taqwa will realize, meaning a person who has karama will realize how beautiful taqwa is. We had talked about taqwa, we had a discussion that we had here as the Hadi family, so I won't go into the definition of taqwa right now, just kind of use the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. So this first one is from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. The Imam defines karama. Innamal karamu. Karama. Islamic dignity. Islamic self-worth. Innamal karamu at-tanazzu anil ma'asi. Is to separate oneself, to distance oneself from sin, ma'asi. Man karumat alayhi nafsu. That person who finds their self to be valuable in God's eyes. Islamic dignity, Islamic self-worth. Man karumat alayhi nafsu lam yuhinha bil ma'asiyah. They won't insult themselves, lower themselves, disgrace themselves with ma'asiyah. What the scholars tell us is, if we want to ever look for a measuring stick, how successful have I been in training myself or my children to have karama, the measuring stick for myself or for my children, is how much does this person want to stay away from sin? For ourselves, right? Because the Imam defined it. Innamal karamu. The only thing that is karama is a tanazzu, avoiding anil ma'asi.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi. عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Britain's former climate chief Alok Sharma has warned that a phase-out of fossil fuels is crucial to limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Irish Times newspaper has covered this story and tells us more. Countries clashed on Saturday, 9th of December, over a proposed agreement to phase out fossil fuels at COP28 summit in Dubai, potentially jeopardizing attempts to deliver a first commitment in 30 years of global warming talks to end the use of oil and gas. Observers said Saudi Arabia and Russia were among several countries insisting the United Nations summit focused only on reducing climate pollution and not on targeting the fossil fuels causing it. On the other side, at least 100 countries, many of them poor countries, climate-vulnerable nations, are demanding a decision calling clearly for an eventual end to the use of fossil fuels. We need realistic approaches to tackle emissions, said OPEC Secretary General Haitham Al-Qais, in comments read out by an official. One that enables economic growth, helps eradicate poverty, and increases resilience at the same time. Earlier this week, the oil-producing group, OPEC, sent a letter urging its members and allies to reject any mention of fossil fuels in the final summit deal, warning that undue and disproportionate pressure against fossil fuels may reach a tipping point. It was the first time OPEC's secretariat has intervened in the United Nations climate talks in such a manner, according to Alden Mayer of think tank E3G. It indicates a whiff of panic, he said. The chairwoman of the elders, Mary Robinson, said it was an indication they're scared about an outcome supporting phase-out of fossil fuels. Saudi Arabia is the top producer in OPEC and de facto leader of the organization, while Russia is a member of the so-called OPEC Plus group. By insisting on focusing on emissions rather than fossil fuels, the two countries appeared to be leaning on the promise of expensive carbon capture technology, which the United Nations Climate Science Panel says cannot take the place of reducing fossil fuel use globally. Other countries, including India and China, have not explicitly endorsed a fossil fuel phase-out. China's top climate envoy, Xi Jinhua, described this year's climate summit as the hardest in his career. Xi Jinhua said, "I have participated in these climate negotiations for the past 16 years. The hardest meeting is this year's meeting. There are so many issues to settle." He said there was little chance the summit would be called a success if nations could not agree on language on the future of fossil fuels. A representative of Russia said in a speech that Moscow was looking into whether some of the roughly $300 billion in gold reserves frozen by the West after the Ukraine war could be used for a climate damage fund for developing countries. British newspaper The Observer has also covered the same story and tells us more. Failure to agree a phase-out of fossil fuels at the United Nations COP28 climate summit would push the world beyond the crucial 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature limit and into climate breakdown, Britain's former climate chief Alok Sharma has warned. Alok Sharma, who was president of the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Scotland, said it was vital that governments made a clear commitment in the next few days to eliminate coal, oil and gas. If you're going to keep to 1.5 degrees Celsius alive, then you're going to have language on a phase-out of fossil fuels, he told The Observer. And you're going to need to accompany that with a credible implementation plan. Alok Sharma urged governments around the world to act. We're running out of time, he said. The window on 1.5 degrees Celsius is closing fast. And unless we're willing to act now with the urgency that this issue demands, we will lose that 1.5 degrees Celsius target. We are literally in the last chance saloon to save our children's future. More than 190 governments are meeting in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, for the final days of the COP28 summit, which runs until next Tuesday, with a question of whether to phase out fossil fuels at the top of the agenda. At least 100 countries are in favour of a phase-out, but some major fossil fuel producers, such as Saudi Arabia, China and India, are opposed. Alok Sharma was credited with keeping 1.5 degrees Celsius target alive against the odds at the Glasgow summit he led in 2021, when he managed to forge a deal among more than 190 squabbling countries that focused on the goal of limiting global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Green campaigners are worried that countries will come under pressure in Dubai from oil producers to weaken any commitment from a phase-out of fossil fuels to a phase-down of fossil fuels. In the final moments of the COP26 summit in Glasgow, China and India threatened to derail the entire agreement unless a commitment to phase-out coal was watered down in this way. Alok Sharma urged ministers to hold firm on the more stringent target this time. The language needs to be unequivocal, he said, so that anyone who reads the agreed language completely understands that what we're talking about here is a phase-out of all fossil fuels. There are also concerns at COP28 summit that countries may opt to phase down only unabated fossil fuels. Exactly what this would mean remain unclear in the text, but abatement refers to the use of fledgling technologies such as carbon capture and carbon storage, which remove carbon dioxide from the air after it is emitted. Alok Sharma rejected the idea that carbon capture or carbon storage could offer a compromise. We have to be really strict with ourselves, he said. If we're going to cut emissions by over 40% by 2030, as scientists say is needed to limit heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, no abatement technology currently exists to allow us to do that. Yes, we have carbon capture and carbon storage, but the price has not been falling fast enough and it is not widely deployed enough for it to make a difference in terms of cutting emissions at the level that we need. Therefore, phasing out the use and production of fossil fuels is clearly something that at this COP summit has to be addressed. The robust intervention by Alok Sharma, one of Britain's most respected figures in climate politics, is likely to be influential at COP28 and stands in stark contrast to the brief visit to the summit by Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak earlier this month. Sunak was widely criticised after he spent barely 12 hours in Dubai, less time than he spent in the private jet that took him there and back. Though Britain is pushing for a phase-out of fossil fuels, Rishi Sunak has vowed to max out the North Sea with new licensing rounds for oil and gas fields, leading to accusations of hypocrisy. Britain's former climate chief, Alok Sharma, said this applies to every country. What you push for at an international level should also be reflected in your domestic policies. There is a feeling among our international partners that Britain has somewhat walked away from the high point of our international climate commitments since the COP26 summit. In Dubai, governments are still debating a draft text that contains several potential options, including a phase-out of fossil fuels and the option of deleting any reference to fossil fuels. It was revealed on Friday that OPEC had written to its member states calling on them to oppose a phase-out of fossil fuels, which OPEC said could mean that pressure against fossil fuels may reach a tipping point with irreversible consequences. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The story of the usurping of Palestine, April 14, 2006. Relying on the backing and support on the part of the United States and Europe, the Zionist regime launched a military offensive on Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon and occupied some parts of their territories with the intention of annexing them. The Zionist regime openly and audaciously made threats to assassinate, kill, and plunder, and notorious terrorists took power one after another in this regime, the last of whom was the infamous butcher of Sabra and Shatila. For tens of years, the usurper Zionist regime remained on the scene of Palestine with a violent, inflexible, and invincible face.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
U.S. is the main culprit in the failure of resolving the Palestinian issue. February 7, 2005. Those powers that claim to oppose tyranny and dictatorship are themselves the most despotic and tyrannical regimes in the world. Even in the case of Palestine, it is the U.S. officials and nobody else that are to blame for the Middle East issue. Even in the case of Palestine, it is the U.S. officials and nobody else that are to blame for the Middle East issue not having been resolved yet. They claim that Iran is preventing the settlement of the Middle East dispute. But it is in fact the U.S. officials that are doing so. Disregarding a nation has no result except this. You are trying to eliminate the Palestinian nation with a several thousand year historical background from the political equations of the region, something which is not possible. This is why you are experiencing defeat and failure. You are supporting and backing up a rabid dog that is attacking Palestinian men, women, children, the young and the elderly. It is clear that the Middle East issue will not be solved in this manner. One should be naive if he thinks that it is possible to trample a nation and still expect them to do nothing in the face of oppression, tyranny, and pressure. This is not possible. It is a few years now since the beginning of the Intifada in Palestine. The young Palestinian generation that is the motive force of the Intifada will not be diverted by worldly enticements. It is not possible to put out the flame of the Intifada unless you recognize the rights of the Palestinian nation and opt for the solution to the issue of Palestine that has been presented by the Islamic Republic. This solution calls for holding a referendum on the future of Palestine among all the Palestinians who belong to this land, and for the establishment of a government based on the results of the referendum. The established government can then decide about the non-Palestinian immigrants currently living in Palestine.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.